We're pleased to have Daniel C. Peterson as one of our speakers. And so with that, we welcome Dan Peterson.
I'm going to be talking about a work in progress that Bill and I are working on right now, entitled God and Mr. Hitchens, Empty Rhetoric, Skewed History, and the New Atheism. We're looking for a publisher. We have several leads on this. We're hoping to do this quickly and get it out. Let me explain who Mr. Hitchens is. Christopher Hitchens is the fourth of what you might call the four horsemen of the New Atheism. Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and now Christopher Hitchens. And he is the author of a book that's been on the bestseller list recently called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And you may notice, if you see it, that God in God Is Not Great is not capitalized. That's sort of emblematic of the very serious and mature approach that he takes to the subject. Some of you have seen Christopher Hitchens on television, I suppose, where he's been a presence for quite some time now as a commentator on politics. He's a British writer who just took U.S. citizenship this past year, just a few months ago, and has appeared recently as a defender of the war in Iraq and the war against terror. It actually makes me somewhat nervous because I'm wondering, having read his book now twice and given some thought to his positions, as to what his motivation is for that. Is it really defense of freedom, or is it just disdain for religion, which is a very, very powerful force in his life? Notice the subtitle of the book again, How Religion Poisons Everything. You may have seen him on television back in the month of May when Jerry Falwell died. He became notorious for what he said then and what he said in a number of venues. This is what he said in Slate magazine. The discovery of the carcass of Jerry Falwell on the floor of an obscure office in Virginia has almost zero significance, except perhaps for two categories of the species labeled credulous idiot. Like many fanatical preachers, Falwell was especially disgusting in exuding an almost sexless personality while railing from dawn to dusk about the sex lives of others. His obsession with homosexuality was on a par with his lip-smacking evocations of hellfire. From his wobbly base of opportunist fundraising and degree mill money spinning in Lynchburg, Virginia, he set out to puddle his sausage-sized fingers into the intimate arrangements of people who had done no harm. It's a shame that there is no hell for Falwell to go to, and it's extraordinary that not even such a scandalous career as his is enough to shake our dumb addiction to the faith-based. It's not the usual kind of obituary. Now, he's famous for also despising Billy Graham, Mahatma Gandhi, and at book length, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. On the other hand, he's not a total misanthrope. He's described Lenin as a great man. He still reveres Leon Trotsky. God Is Not Great is explicitly contemptuous of religious believers at excruciating detail. He despises Jerry Falwell for his crimes, but as I say, admires Leon Trotsky, who was famous for saying, among other things, that we needed to get beyond the Quaker papist babble about the sanctity of life. And Trotsky put that into force, as with Lenin, he was the co-architect of the Gulag in the Soviet Union, leading to the deaths of potentially as many as 40 million people. Here are just a few things out of many, many things that could be picked up. I mean, I'm picking from an embarrassment of riches here. All religions, he says, have staunchly resisted any attempt to translate their sacred texts into languages understood of the people. Now, what are the facts? According to the United Bible Societies, the Bible has been translated into 2,167 languages, with another 320 in process. And this is by no means merely a modern phenomenon. The Bible was the most widely translated book in the ancient world. It was translated into Greek, the Septuagint, in the 2nd century BC, Aramaic by the 1st century BC, Old Latin by the 2nd century AD, the Syriac, Peshitta, in the 3rd century AD, Coptic, Egyptian, 4th century AD, Old German, or Gothic, in the 4th century AD. Jerome's Latin Vulgate that's been talked about here was done in the late 4th century. Armenian, early 5th century. Ethiopic, 5th century. Georgian, 5th century. Old Nubian by the 8th century. Old Slavonic by the 9th. Christian Arabic and Sadia Gaon's Jewish Arabic version by the 10th. Get the idea here? There has been a lot of translation effort that's gone into this. The history of the translation of the Buddhist scriptures is precisely the same. So this statement that he's making draws on one thing. He's trying to universalize a very isolated phenomenon connected with a specific religious controversy, and that is the one regarding the translation of scripture during the Protestant Reformation. But even in this limited context, his argument is based on unsubstantiated assertion. There would have been no Protestant Reformation, he assures us, if it were not for the long struggle to have the Bible rendered into the Vulgate. Now think about this one. Aside from the obvious fact that the term Vulgate refers not to translations of the Bible into the vernacular, but to a particular late 4th century translation by Jerome, already referred to, translating the Bible into German as an issue of the Reformation never appears among Luther's original 95 Theses. It wasn't a major issue of the Reformation. In fact, the Bible had been translated into German in the 14th century. And a German Bible had been printed by Gutenberg in 1466, 13 years after his publication of the Latin Bible. By the time Luther had nailed his theses to the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church on the 31st of October in 1517, the act that's generally regarded as the beginning, the opening salvo on the Protestant Reformation, Gutenberg's German Bible was nearly 65 years old. So how serious an issue could this have been for Luther? He made his own, and his own Bible is tremendously important for German culture. But it was not a major issue in the Reformation and the polemics. Now, turning specifically to the English Bible, various parts of the Bible had been likewise translated into Anglo-Saxon from the 7th century on, with interlinear Latin Anglo-Saxon versions by the 10th century. The Venerable Bede, one of the greatest figures in ecclesiastical history in Britain, who died in AD 735, is said to have translated the Gospel of John into Anglo-Saxon. The problem during most of the medieval period was not that the church was attempting to suppress the translation of the Bible. This may come as a shock to some Latter-day Saints who've heard this story. But that all literate persons in the early Middle Ages knew Latin. There was no particular point in having another translation. The other people couldn't read. Hitchens laments, and I love this one, that devout men like Wycliffe, Carverdale, and Tyndale were burned alive for even attempting early translations of the Bible into vernacular literature. This is another example of the care with which he approaches his research. Far from being burned at the stake, John Wycliffe died while hearing Catholic Mass in his parish church. Miles Carverdale died unburned in 1568 at the age of 81. Of the three translators mentioned by Hitchens, only William Tyndale, ironically also known as Hitchens, was burned at the stake. Here's an example of biblical interpretation as he does it, the Akedah, the near sacrifice of Abraham's son. Hitchens' polemics fail completely to put this into context. In his discussion of the Akedah, or Abraham's binding or near sacrifice of his son Isaac, Hitchens describes it as mad and gloomy, a frightful and vile delusion. He says there is no softening the plain meaning of this frightful story that God would require humans to sacrifice their children. But this is not the message the ancient audience would have gotten from that story. The message they would have gotten is God does not require the sacrifice of their children. Instead, he allows a substitutionary sacrifice instead of human sacrifice. There are other biblical problems that he points to. According to Hitchens, quote, the Old Testament is riddled with dreams and with astrology, the sun standing still so that Joshua can complete his massacre at a site that has never been located. Well, first of all, the sun standing still has nothing to do with astrology, which develops centuries later. The other thing is that Gibeon, the site where the battle occurred, can be located in any biblical atlas. It's an easily found site. Okay, on the New Testament. For Hitchens, the New Testament exceeds the evil of the Old. That's astonishing to me, really. It shows how extreme his case is. Most people will point to the evils of the Old Testament God, but they kind of feel comfortable, even if they're agnostics, with the New Testament God. But for him, Christianity is even worse than the ancient Hebrew religion. And it's very difficult to imagine the New Testament being worse because he has boundless scorn for the Old Testament. Hitchens' basic argument is, quote, the case for biblical consistency or authenticity or inspiration has been in tatters for some time, and thus no revelation can be derived from that quarter. Like the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament is for Hitchens merely a crude forgery. So any evangelical anti-Mormons who take pleasure in his description of the Book of Mormon as a crude forgery will have the smiles erased from their faces pretty soon when he gets to the Bible. He feels the same way about that. It was hammered together long after its purported events. The notion that the Gospels could be based on eyewitness accounts is a patently fraudulent claim. It's an error to assume that the four Gospels were in any sense a historical record. Now, there happens to be on the question of eyewitness testimony in the New Testament a fascinating new book by Richard Bauckham called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony, which argues meticulously, I think, that you can argue, or the case is, that the New Testament Gospels are in fact based on eyewitness accounts, that they have access to eyewitness testimony. Whether they were written by the eyewitnesses or simply on the basis of eyewitness testimony is a matter of irrelevance to him. The fact is they go back apparently to very specific eyewitness testimony, and he is very careful in laying this out. Of course, Hitchens pays no attention to these sorts of things. His research, as I say, is limited largely to Google and a handful of endnotes. The most outrageous assertions are made, and you look in the back for any justification for them, nothing. He'll go 20, 30 pages without any kind of documentation whatsoever. This is one that I like. Hitchens, it's probably not coincidental that Hitchens provides no scholarly sources for his claim that the Gospels as we have them were based on oral accounts. Why doesn't he provide any documentation for that? Because the consensus of even secular biblical scholars is precisely the opposite of his claim. Matthew and Luke use at least two written sources, Mark and Q, according to the consensus. And that's the Q is an abbreviation for the German Quelle, of course, which means source. It's essentially defined as passages found in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark, all right? Now, Hitchens is aware of this hypothetical source Q. Remember, he's talking about consensus accounts. But he understands it in a hopelessly garbled fashion. He describes it as the book on which all four Gospels may possibly have been based. He says it's known speculatively to scholars as Q. Now note first that Hitchens is aware that Q is a written source, a book, which is a direct contradiction of his claim that the Gospels are based on oral sources. Then notice, well, he simply can't have it both ways. But he's further mistaken. He claims that all four Gospels were based on Q, all four of them. Now, in reality, only two are thought, even by the consensus he refers to have used Q, Matthew and Luke. John has nothing to do with Q. John is not one of the synoptic Gospels. And Q is defined precisely as the material common to Matthew and Luke, but not found in Mark. So where does he get off saying that Q is the source for all four Gospels? There's no one who holds that, let alone a consensus. He's also mistaken in his claim that all of Jesus' disciples were illiterate. Presumably he's making this claim in order to lessen their value as witnesses. Presumably illiterate people are stupid and can't recognize what they see or record it or remember it accurately or dictate it to anyone accurately. In fact, there's no evidence for their illiteracy, and in fact considerable evidence against it. There are lots of cases of them writing letters, of Jesus reading, for example. That the early Christian movement was dominated by illiterates is simply unsupported in the sources. He also describes the Gospels as late. Because they're late, of course, they can't be trusted as history. But there are a lot of arguments for early dating for the sources, for the Gospels. For example, it's generally agreed by New Testament scholars that the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts were written by the same author. So people routinely talk of Luke-Acts. Acts ends with Paul preaching in Rome for 2 years as a fulfillment of God's plan to bring the Gospel to the Gentiles. But it doesn't mention the death of Paul, which is thought to have occurred sometime between AD 62 and 65. If Acts was written after the death of Paul, why did the author not mention that kind of important fact? Although various explanations have been suggested, the most obvious conclusion is that Acts was written before the death of Paul, that is in the early 60s. Since the Gospel of Luke was clearly written before Acts, this gives a date in the early 60s at the latest for the composition of the Gospel of Luke. Since it's widely agreed that Luke is dependent upon Mark, this gives a date for Mark in the late 50s at the latest. In fact, the main reason consistently given for the dating of the Gospels to after AD 70 is that Jesus prophesies the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem. Since Jesus predicts the destruction of the Temple, and as atheists assure us, since there's no such thing as real prophecy, the Gospels must have been written after that destruction occurred, so in other words, after AD 70. But in fact, that's a very, very weak argument. We may be looking at documents that are written as early as within roughly 20 years of the death of Christ. Now, how does that compare to secular historiography from the ancient world? Hitchens seems to be under the impression that we're just awash in ancient documents that were written by eyewitnesses, to many of the events that we talk about in ancient history. But listen to this. The earliest surviving biography of Alexander the Great by Diodorus dates to nearly three centuries after Alexander's death. Livy's account of the campaigns of Hannibal was written over a century and a half after the death of that general in 182 BC. Tacitus wrote his Annals about AD 115. His book covers imperial Roman history from AD 14 to 68, meaning that he wrote about 50 to 100 years after the events he describes. Suetonius wrote his history of the Caesars in the early second century. His biography of Julius Caesar was thus written over a century and a half after the event. You get the point here? That by the standards of the ancient world, the Gospels are amazingly close, even if you give them a fairly late date. They're very, very close to the events they narrate. Herodotus wrote non-eyewitness accounts of the Persian War, and it was written up to half a century after the events he describes. Our major surviving source for the lives and teachings of most ancient philosophers is Diogenes Laertius, who wrote centuries after many of the men whose lives he records. Plutarch's famous biographies, Plutarch's Lives, are likewise often centuries after the fact. Hitchens clearly has no understanding of ancient historiography. If we were to go by his standards, we could know essentially nothing about the ancient world. All ancient history as it's taught, apart from the Gospels, secular ancient history, would have to be tossed. Now, one of the things that's noteworthy about his approach is that he completely ignores Paul, who's our earliest surviving source for the life of Jesus. You can reconstruct a lot of the life of Jesus and the account of the resurrection and all those really important things from the letters of Paul. But Paul apparently wrote before the Gospels, probably the letters that are universally recognized as authentic, in the 50s. Again, early. We're talking about a gap of about 20 years between the death of Christ and the writing of Paul's letters. Let me go through a few miscellaneous errors here that I think are illustrative of, again, Hitchens' seriousness and how seriously he should be taken. One of my favorite is an epigraph that he has at the heading of one of his chapters. He's trying to show that all serious Christian thinkers are idiots. And so he has to take on one of the biggest, Thomas Aquinas, the greatest philosopher of the Middle Ages, certainly in the West. Thomas Aquinas is given a quote, it's placed in his mouth, "I am a man of one book." You know, the Bible, obviously. Now, I could not remember ever running across a quote like that from Thomas Aquinas, any passage that ever said that. In fact, anybody who's read Thomas Aquinas knows that he's constantly citing Aristotle, early Greek commentators on Aristotle, Avicenna, Arabic philosophers. He's drawing on all sorts of sources. He's a man of scores, if not hundreds of books. By the standards of the Middle Ages, this guy's a walking library. So why would he say, "I'm a man of one book"? Well, what a big surprise. He didn't. Hitchens says he said it, but he didn't. In fact, if you do a Google search for him, again, I'm trying to follow Hitchens' research methodology here. You come up with a quotation attributed to him, which is actually probably not authentic either, where he says, "Beware the man of one book." That's the opposite. I actually was so curious about this that I wrote to Ralph McInerney at Notre Dame. He's one of the leading Aquinas scholars in the world. And he wrote back and said, "Good grief, you know, where'd that come from?" He says, "Just tell somebody to look at the notes in his texts." He's quoting all sorts of things. This is an outrageous misrepresentation of Aquinas. Another outrageous misrepresentation, he's trying to show that religion is evil in all its effects. So one example is Pius XII, the Pope during World War II, who he describes as a pro-Nazi Pope. Now, I will not get into this in any detail, but let me just say, that's absurd. I know it's a common charge, it's absurd. The best book on it that I've seen is one written by Rabbi David Dallin, who's a professor of history back on the East Coast, called The Myth of Hitler's Pope. If anyone takes that seriously at all, have a look at this book. It's devastating to the claim. Here's one thing that Rabbi Dallin doesn't mention. I can sort of understand why, but I think this is significant. The chief rabbi of Rome, a fellow by the name of Israel Soli, at the end of World War II, said this: "What the Vatican did in terms of saving Jews will be indelibly and eternally engraved in our hearts. Priests and even high prelates did things that will forever be an honor to Catholicism." After the war, Soli became a Catholic. This is the chief rabbi of Rome. And to honor the Pope for what he had done for the Jews and for the role he had played in Soli's own conversion, he took the name of Eugenio, which was Eugenio Pacelli, Pope Pius the XII's given name, in honor of the Pope and as gratitude for his baptismal name. Now, Hitchens, at this remove of time, can describe Pius XII as a pro-Nazi. The Nazis didn't feel that way. There's a new book out called, what is it, a special mission about Hitler's plot to kidnap Pope Pius XII and execute him, which is what Hitler often did to his most faithful supporters, right? Now, here's another tendency that you see running throughout Hitchens' book. Anything that's good is secular. Anything that's bad is a believer, a faithful person. For example, he admires Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who died as a martyr against Hitler in 1945, just shortly before the end of World War II. Bonhoeffer was a pastor, a radical Christian who believed in a radical discipleship of Christ, and that led him into opposition to the Nazis. So Hitchens says that he wasn't really a believer, that he was motivated by a vague humanism. Karl Barth, who was another prominent opponent of Hitler, who is probably the most prominent Protestant theologian of the 20th century, is omitted altogether, even though he's the principal author of the principal Protestant statement denouncing Nazism. Okay? Because that doesn't count. That doesn't fit the narrative that he's trying to tell. Martin Luther King, whom he greatly admires, turns out not to have been a Christian at all. Now, that would have been a shock to King, who got a theology doctorate at Boston University, and you know, whose speeches are just laden with biblical imagery. But no, he wasn't a believer either. Secularists, it turns out, were the ones who ended slavery. John Brown, you might have heard of him. John Brown was this militant Calvinist preacher who opposed slavery. It turns out he was a secularist too, according to Hitchens. There's no mention of William Wilberforce. Anyone see the recent movie called Amazing Grace, about William Wilberforce and the Christian opposition to slavery, the British slave trade? This was an evangelical movement led by Wilberforce and his friend John Newton, who wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. John Newton's not mentioned. William Wilberforce isn't mentioned. It turns out that slavery was done away with in the United Kingdom by secularists. There's no mention in his account of the end of slavery of the Underground Railroad. What's the significance of that? Or Sojourner Truth, or Harriet Tubman, or the Battle Hymn of the Republic, or Harriet Beecher Stowe. Remember the family we heard about from Terrell Givens yesterday, the Beechers. Great preacher family. Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, the little lady who launched the war, right? No mention of them, because religious people can't ever do anything good. On the other hand, everything that's bad is done by religious people. For example, religious people put an end to science, tried to stomp it out wherever they could. And of course, he gets into the old standard warfare of science versus religion stuff. Now, I don't have time to expand on this, but merely to say that the latest interpretations of the history of science suggest that science grew up, interestingly enough, not in China, not in the Islamic world, not in India. Technologies did. Science grew up in Christian Europe. Why? Probably specifically because of attributes of Christian culture in Europe. Look at the works of Stanley Jacky or Pierre Duhem, other people who are writing on the subject of the history of science. This is pretty much the consensus view right now. But Hitchens doesn't know about it, or if he knows, he's not telling. Science and belief are enemies. They're absolutely opposed to one another. Galileo, of course, is invoked. But Galileo is the one who, unbeknownst to Hitchens, said, "We read about God in two books, the book of the scriptures and the book of nature." He was a religious man, but he has to be painted as a secularist. One of my favorite cases is Sir Fred Hoyle, probably one of the greatest, most brilliant physicists of the 20th century. He was a British agnostic. But in Hitchens' book, he shows up as a creationist. Some of you may remember, if you grew up about the time I did, there were two viable alternatives for the origin of the universe, the Big Bang and the steady state theory. Fred Hoyle was the founder of the steady state theory. And Hitchens portrays him as being opposed to the Big Bang because the Big Bang threatened his theism. Now, Hoyle was an agnostic or an atheist. He's got to completely turn around. In many cases, Hitchens is 180 degrees wrong. He is so far wrong that if he moved at all, he'd be coming back toward right. But he does this constantly. In the case of Hoyle, it is amusing. Hoyle was probably having doubts about his atheism toward the end. He's the one, and Hitchens just goes ballistic at this, who said that looking at the theory of evolution, it reminded him of the idea that a storm hits a junkyard, and when it's done, a Boeing 747 has emerged. But he was by no means an ardent Christian. The irony, I might say, about this is that although Hitchens sees the Big Bang as the enemy of religion, guess who was one of the earliest people to just love the Big Bang? He went so far that his advisors criticized him for it and asked him to restrain himself. Pope Pius XII, you know, the pro-Nazi. He thought it was a wonderful thing. It reminded him of Genesis 1. And so he pushed the Big Bang. And not surprisingly, why? Because this great atheist theory, the Big Bang, was originated to at least a large extent by Georges Lemaître, who was a Belgian priest and mathematician and physicist. So he's got the history of science turned on its head. He doesn't know what he's talking about, but this is just typical. Here's another amusing part of what he has to say. The loss of faith, he says, can be compensated by the newer and finer wonders that we have before us, as well as by immersion in the near miraculous work of Homer and Shakespeare and Milton and Tolstoy and Proust, all of which was man-made. Now, Homer without religion? What do you make of the story of the... Well, anyway. You lose about half of it right there. Tolstoy without religion, he would have been shocked by that. But the one that really gets me is Milton without religion. Here are the opening lines of Paradise Lost. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe, with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat, sing, heavenly muse. What in me is dark illumine, what is low raise and support, that to the height of this great argument I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men. That's the purpose statement of Paradise Lost. So, you know, get rid of religion, but read your Milton. Imagine Dante without religion. Well, I've tried to imagine Chaucer's Canterbury Tales without religion. Pilgrimage to what? Where are they going? It sort of reminds me of the joke about, you know, you cross an atheist or an agnostic with a Jehovah's Witness, what do you get? Someone who goes door to door for no obvious reason. You remove religion from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and where are they going to go? Well, but he asks us to contemplate a world without religion, and I invite you to contemplate that same world. Imagine a world without Bach's St. Matthew Passion, without Handel's Messiah, without Mozart's Requiem, without Stravinsky, without John Taverner, without John Coltrane, heck, without Brian Wilson, without cathedrals, without the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. I mean, it's all gone. You cannot imagine that you just get rid of the bad parts of religion, and you're still going to have all the good things. You get rid of it all. What are you left with? Instead of the Cathedral of Chartres, maybe a Quonset hut, something purely functional. Well, here's a really serious point. Totalitarian atrocities. The 1997 Black Book of Communism estimates the total deaths caused by communism at between 85 and 100 million. But I think even the highest of those figures may be low. There's a relatively new biography of Mao out that credits him with 70 million deaths on his own in peacetime. You've still got to factor in Stalin and Trotsky and Lenin and all those. And then, of course, there are the Nazis. Now, Hitchens realizes that such facts pose a threat to the atheism he advocates, because religion is supposed to be guilty of all these crimes, and secularism will introduce a brave new world of peace and justice and harmony and all that sort of thing, but it doesn't seem to work. So what does he do? He takes a fairly daring step. He declares that religion created totalitarianism. And he points, for example, the Jesuit reductions in Paraguay. You may remember them from the Robert De Niro movie, The Mission, a really, really fine movie, done set around Iguazu Falls, a really gorgeous area. That is an early totalitarian state where the Indians were kept in terror and fear by these Jesuit priests. Now, let me tell you about these Jesuit priests. There were two of them for every 3,500 Indians who were free to come and go anytime they wanted. What kind of terrorist totalitarian state is that? He's completely misrepresented them. And then he goes on to say that all totalitarianism is religious. It didn't only originate in religion, but all totalitarianism, you thought you knew about Stalin, all totalitarianism is actually theocratic. It's all religious stuff. Believers are guilty for that too. Okay? He says of Saddam Hussein, "I shall simply say that those who regarded his regime as a secular one are deluding themselves." Well, I hereby declare myself deluded. Saddam Hussein was less of a Muslim than I am. And the Ba'athist state was a fascist state. Ba'athist ideology was founded by a lapsed Christian named Michel Aflaq. Saddam Hussein was a nominal Muslim, but his chief deputy, Tariq Aziz, was a Christian, you know, of the kind that Vito Corleone was a Christian, but still a Christian of some sort, at least nominally. What kind of a theocracy is this? After 1979, it's true that Saddam Hussein, being a thug, but a fairly clever thug and a survivor, knew which way the wind was blowing, so he discovered, for example, that he was a descendant of the prophet Muhammad. And who would dare to question him on that? And then he also put Allahu Akbar on the Iraqi flag, you know, God is most great, because he knew which way the winds were blowing. But he never showed any signs of serious religion. He persecuted religious leaders in Iraq. He killed them by the thousands, Shiite and Sunni both. It wasn't like he only favored the Sunnis. He disliked them all. Anybody who was a threat to him died. So this is a preposterous claim on his part, but here's another one. He's more overt than this, but I happen to love this passage. This is a description of Stalin's experiments with, you may remember, Lysenko. If you've ever read about Soviet history, a guy named Trofim Lysenko, who launched a new theory of Marxist genetics. It was insane. You know, reject Mendel and all that sort of scientific nonsense and go with Marxist-Leninist thought on genetics. Lots of people starved to death as a result of his agricultural experiments. So Hitchens, who remember is an ex-Trotskyite who really admires Lenin and Trotsky and the Soviet experiment, says, Stalin pedantically repeated the papal routine. Note that word, papal. Repeated the papal routine of making science conform to dogma by insisting that the shaman and charlatan, shaman? You know, religious language again, the shaman and charlatan Trofim Lysenko had disclosed the key to genetics and promised extra harvests of specially inspired vegetables. Inspired. Millions of innocents died of gnawing internal pain as a consequence of this revelation. Now that is just rhetorical irresponsibility. But notice the religious language. Inspiration, revelation, shaman, papal, bringing up the papacy, all of which has to do with a completely atheist regime, a militantly atheist regime. Listen to a description of the death of the great theocrat and believer Stalin. Joseph Stalin died a horrific death in March 1953. He had suffered a severe stroke that left his right side paralyzed, and his last hours were spent in virtually unbearable pain. Slowly, he was strangled to death. As his daughter Svetlana later reported, her father choked to death as those around his deathbed looked on. Although at the very last he had seemed at most merely semi-conscious, he suddenly opened his eyes and looked about the room, plainly terrified. At that point, according to Svetlana, quote, something incomprehensible and awesome happened that to this day I can't forget and don't understand. Stalin partially lifted himself in the bed, clenched his fist toward the heavens, and shook it defiantly. Then, with an unintelligible murmur, he dropped motionless back onto his pillow and died. It was a holy death. Now, I'm going to do something here. I'm going to read a somewhat lengthy passage because I want to make a point here. I find Hitchens, in many regards, simply absurd, but in one aspect, obscene. It's his attempt to blame the atrocities of the Nazis and the communists on religious believers. So I want to read this little portion that I've just been putting together in the past couple of days. Lenin wrote to Maxim Gorky in 1913 that, quote, any religious idea is the most dangerous foulness, the most shameful infection, and worship is no more than ideological necrophilia. In 1921, by now firmly in control of the country, he called upon the Communist Party to adopt a program of militant atheism and militant materialism. Now remember, Hitchens is an admirer of Lenin. Accordingly, the atheist weekly, The Godless, began publication in 1922, and a monthly journal entitled The Godless in the Workplace was launched. In 1923, the party set up the League of the Godless. In 1924, doesn't this sound like a theocratic state to you? In 1924, a society of militant materialists was established. The relatively highbrow magazine Atheist began to appear, and the party launched a national campaign of atheistic propaganda and scientific demonstrations. By 1929, the League of the Godless had 465,000 members, 9,000 cells of atheist agitators, and it changed its name to the League of the Militant Godless. In 1932, it could claim 5.6 million members. Museums of scientific atheism were built across the country. During 1940, 239,000 anti-religious lectures were delivered to an estimated audience of 11 million nationwide under the auspices of the League. But the Bolsheviks weren't content with propaganda. In 1922, Orthodox churches were ordered to surrender all of their treasures, including chalices and clerical vestments, over to the state. When the Patriarch tried to retain objects related to church sacraments, they were seized by force. More than 8,000 members of the clergy were killed during the process of expropriation. And over 1,400 violent clashes are recorded between agents of the state and angry believers. By 1930, estimates the British historian Richard Overy, a fifth of all of those imprisoned in the far northern Solovki prison camp complex were clerical victims of religious persecution. By 1940, the overwhelming majority of churches, chapels, mosques, synagogues, and monasteries had been either dynamited, closed down, or seized by the state for some other use. Whereas the Russian Orthodox Church had 46,457 churches and 1,028 monasteries at the time of the revolution in 1917, by 1939 there were fewer than 1,000 still in operation, and some estimates put the number as low as 100. 600 religious communities existed in Moscow in 1917. By 1939, only 20 survived. The famous Stratnoy Monastery, for example, located in the heart of the city, was converted into the National Anti-Religious Museum. I remember the church in St. Petersburg, formerly Leningrad, the St. Isaac's Cathedral, was, according to the guides we had there under the Soviet Union, donated to the state by the by the Russian Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. Alexander Solzhenitsyn puts the proportion of women imprisoned for their religion at Solovki, a facility he knew during his own imprisonment, at about a third. When the women of the religious commune near Khosta were arrested and sent to Solovki, their children were left to fend for themselves on their farms. They tended the orchards and vegetable gardens, milked their goats, studied hard at school, and sent their grades to their parents. Solzhenitsyn says, together with assurances that they were prepared to suffer for God as their mothers had, and of course the party soon gave them the opportunity. At that time, Solzhenitsyn says, at the very beginnings of the Soviet system under Hitchens, much admired Lenin and Trotsky, the authorities used to love to set up their concentration camps in form of monasteries. They were enclosed by strong walls, had good solid buildings, and they were empty. After all, monks were not human beings and could be tossed out at will. In Moscow, for example, there were concentration camps in at least three monasteries. Others were located in empty nunneries as early as September 1918. Men of religion, says Solzhenitsyn, were an inevitable part of every annual catch, and their silver locks gleamed in every cell and in every prisoner transport en route to the Solovetsky Islands. From the early 20s on, arrests were also made among groups of theosophists, mystics, spiritualists, religious societies, and philosophers of the Berdyaev circle. They were arrested and destroyed in passing. Of course, ordinary Roman Catholics, Polish Catholic priests, etc., were arrested too, as part of the normal course of events. However, the root destruction of religion in the country, which throughout the 20s and 30s was one of the most important goals of the government, could only be achieved by mass arrests of Orthodox believers. Monks and nuns, whose black habits had been a distinctive feature of old Russian life, were intensively rounded up on every hand, placed under arrest, and sent into exile. They arrested and sentenced active laymen. The circles kept getting bigger as they raked in ordinary believers as well, old people, and particularly women, who were the most stubborn believers of all. True, they were supposedly being arrested and tried not for their actual faith, but for openly declaring their convictions and for bringing up their children in the same spirit. As Tanya Khodkhevich wrote, "You can pray freely, but just so God alone can hear." She received a 10-year sentence for that verse. A person convinced that he possessed spiritual truth was required to conceal it from his own children. In the 20s, the religious education of children was classified as a political crime under Article 5810 of the Code. Now, such people, Solzhenitsyn observes, typically received 10-year sentences to the labor camps. They were prohibited from returning to their children and homes, even upon their release. By contrast, prostitutes customarily received 3-year sentences, continued to ply their trade among camp administrators and guards, and then returned home bearing suitcases laden with gifts. The number of Orthodox parish priests fell from approximately 40,000 in the late 20s to roughly 4,000 in 1940, and this was by no means merely the result of natural attrition or a national loss of interest in religion. Many had been executed as counter-revolutionaries or died in prison camps, while unknown numbers were in hiding. Jewish and Muslim religious figures suffered similar fates. After 1929, religious study groups and Bible circles were banned. Religious youth and women's groups were prohibited. Church reading rooms and libraries were closed, and religious instruction was outlawed. Taxes on the incomes of religious workers were raised to 100%. Civil service workers were fired if their fathers had been Orthodox priests. People who refused to work on Sundays were imprisoned. Some religious believers were deliberately starved to death. One stream has never dried up in the USSR, Alexander Solzhenitsyn could still write in the 1970s with reference to the river of prisoners going to the labor camps, and it still flows, a stream of criminals untouched by the beneficent waves summoned to life by the revolution. A stream which flowed uninterruptedly through all those decades, whether Leninist norms were infringed or strictly observed, and flowed in Khrushchev's day more furiously than ever. I mean the believers. those who resisted the new wave of cruel persecution, the wholesale closing of churches, monks who were slung out of their monasteries. These are in no sense politicals, they're religionists, but still they have to be re-educated. Believers must be dismissed from their jobs merely for their faith. Komsomols must be sent along to break the windows of believers. Believers must be officially compelled to attend anti-religious lectures. Church doors must be cut down with blowtorches, domes pulled down with hawsers attached to tractors, gatherings of old women broken up with fire hoses. Do you see why I think it's obscene for Christopher Hitchens to be suggesting that religious believers were responsible for the Soviet Union? Well, another thing he says they're responsible for, and I know I need to quit very, very soon, I'll try to hurry, is religion and violence. Hitchens objects to the violence that he says is caused by religion, and he specifically targets suicide bombings as an example of that evil thing. Still, although he apparently doesn't realize it, he makes a crucial admission when he acknowledges that the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka pioneered the disgusting tactic of suicide murder long before Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, as he puts it. While true to form, he seeks to paint the violence in Sri Lanka as a religious war between Buddhists and Hindus, the Tamil Tigers are not motivated by religion. He acknowledges that the conflict is one of ethnic tribalism, but he attempts to obscure its reality by pointing out that the Tamils are chiefly Hindu. Note that important word, chiefly. I mean, some of them aren't. And that the strife is reinforced by religion. Now, here are the theological demands made in 1985 by a confederacy of Tamil militant groups. Listen to the language of theology here. One, the Tamils are to be recognized as a distinct nationality. Two, they are to be recognized and guaranteed their territorial integrity in the traditional homelands of the Ceylon Tamils. Three, the right of self-determination of the Tamil nation should be guaranteed. And four, recognition of citizenship and fundamental rights of all Tamils who regard Ceylon as their home should be promised. Do you hear a single word about religion in that? There isn't any. But that's deeply significant. Robert Pape, a political scientist at the University of Chicago, compiled a database of every single suicide bombing and suicide attack worldwide from 1980 through 2003, 315 attacks altogether, and carefully analyzed them. In a 2005 book entitled Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, he concludes that, quote, while it might seem obvious that Islamic fundamentalism is the central cause, the presumed connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism is misleading. In fact, he writes, and this is really important and it may be a surprise to you, the data show that there is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism or any one of the world's religions. In fact, the leading instigators of suicide attacks are the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, a Marxist-Leninist group, that's Trotsky territory, Lenin territory, Hitchens territory, a Marxist-Leninist group whose members are from Hindu families but who are adamantly opposed to religion. This group committed 76 of the 315 incidents, more suicide attacks than Hamas. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal, to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland. Religion is rarely the root cause, although it is often used as a tool by terrorist organizations in recruiting and in other efforts in service of the broader strategic objective. Okay. Religion and war. David Martin, who's an emeritus professor of sociology at the London School of Economics, is responding to a book by Richard Dawkins, a friend and ally of Hitchens. He says, from a sociological viewpoint, the role and nature of religion varies according to the kind of society in which it's present, and its relationship to warfare will likewise vary. That's why statements to the effect that religion causes war are not likely to be taken very seriously by sociologists. And we heard earlier today about Erwin Staub, the fellow who wrote about the causes of violence. Religion is only one factor among many in those cases. Martin continues to say, I know of no evidence to show that the absence of a religious factor in the contention of rival identities and incompatible claims leads to a diminution in the degree of enmity and ferocity. The contribution of religion has instead been of signal importance, and it's always been almost entirely directed to peaceful reconciliation internally and peace in foreign affairs. If Dawkins' arguments were correct, he says, then the separating out of believers and clergy from the general population ought to reveal them as major proponents of violence towards each other and violence in international affairs. This is far from being the case. The evidence does not bear out the contention. The case falls. Now, in fact, the cause of violence is what it always is, and it happens with religious people and non-religious people. Lust, greed, irritability, urge to power, all those sorts of things. Religion is a factor, but not a major factor. as my son put it to me a few weeks ago, Hitchens seems to be saying that without religion, we could all just hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Except that, of course, we couldn't sing Kumbaya, because it's a religious song. Now, there's so many other things that could be said about this, but I won't say them. Mercifully, it's coming to an end. But one claim that he makes in particular that I found striking, he says that Islam has ruined the culture of Persia. The culture of Persia is Islamic. The greatest writers of the Persian tradition are Islamic writers. The Persian miniature paintings are Islamic paintings. The greatest poet of Persia is Jalal ad-Din Rumi, who's an Islamic mystical poet. His book, the Mathnavi, is often called the Second Quran or the Persian Quran. If you get rid of Islam, you get rid of every major poet in the Persian tradition. You get rid of every major bit of Persian architecture. You get rid of every bit of Persian artistry and painting. Statements like this are abysmally ignorant. It's just astonishing. Well, let me just say, God is not great. Some of you I've discovered haven't even heard of the book. That's great. More power to you. It's been on the bestseller list, but fine. But it's crammed to the bursting point with errors. And the ironic thing, the interesting thing, the striking thing about this is the errors are always, always in Hitchens' favor. Now, if you have an accountant or a cashier or something, you know, who makes errors, and they're sort of random, sometimes one way, sometimes another way, you think, okay, that's all right. But if the bank teller is always making the error in her favor, begin to smell a rat. Well, I smell a rat in this case. The errors are, there is not a disputed fact or a fact that struck me as questionable that I've checked in Hitchens' book that is where it has not turned out that he's wrong. Every single time. It reminds me of a very famous review of a book by Lillian Hellman. She wrote a memoir called Scoundrel Time, and it was reviewed by her old, longtime archenemy, Mary McCarthy, who was on a television show, PBS, the old Dick Cavett show. And at one point, this is in 1979, when he asked her about the book Scoundrel Time, she said famously, and this led to a lawsuit, "Every word Lillian Hellman writes is a lie, including and the." Well, I'm not saying that Hitchens is lying, but I am saying there's virtually not a sentence in this book that is true. It's absolutely astonishing. He's become a millionaire with this book, which gives me hope. By reputation, I'm a constant liar too, so the future is bright. Anyway, it's a remarkable thing, and I've said before that I think that the secular critique of Mormonism, of religious belief, is a much more serious one now than the evangelical critique, which we've been experiencing for so long. And I thought when this book first came out, this was going to be a formidable challenge. This is a remarkable fellow. He writes well. He's written extensively. He's traveled the world. He's a formidable presence on television. It is truly disappointing, or in another sense, really exhilarating to realize how bad the case is. Thank you very much. One question. Why do people publish or read this stuff? Is it just our appetite for tabloid news, sensational stuff? Well, I think that that his arguments, such as they are, they're hardly arguments. They're really a series of poses or attitudes. They are very much in line with a certain vocal minority in the West that is very hostile and opposed to religion, and that fears with the seeming resurgence of religion. They're actually terrified by the rise of fundamentalist Islam and so on. There's good reason for that. But they also sense the rise of a fundamentalist theocracy and the rise of the Mormons or the evangelicals in the South. I mean, they're living in abject terror of you know, George Bush the theocrat and all that sort of thing. I mean, I think we're about to enter into Calvin's Geneva. And so there is an audience for this, and it has made him a lot of money, and presumably his publisher a lot of money as well. So still, I think he's probably preaching to the choir as much as anything. Do I recommend that we read God Is Not Great? No. You know, but I'm not warning you against it. I mean, if you want to, fine. I'm not saying it's dangerous to read. It's not. It's a piece of garbage. But I have heard of people who've read it and have been convinced by it. I know one fellow whose son, inactive in the church, has read it and has decided that this is the greatest thing ever. This is a real manifesto against religion, and he has made the case as strongly as possible. Oh, and in fact, I'll tell you one endorsement. The only critic that I know of who's endorsed the book wholeheartedly, who's declared Hitchens to be his new hero, is Steve Benson. That may mean something to some of you. What do you think is Hitchens' motivation? He absolutely hates religion and religious people. That word is not too strong. It's abundantly clear on every page of the book. He claims to have had an epiphany at the age of 9. Now, there's a really funny aspect to this. He has a brother, Peter, who disagrees with him on every issue, including religion, and is also a journalist. And they've occasionally debated. They go through periods of 6 or 7 years where they don't speak. And Peter has actually made fun of his brother's claim to have had an epiphany at the age of 9, in which he understood that religion was false and that no arguments for religion could possibly be true. You know, it's one thing to have an epiphany like that if you believe in a God who can give you epiphanies. But if you're in a world of atoms and the void, as Peter Hitchens says, for my brother to have figured out all the big issues that philosophers have argued about for the past 2,500 years when he was 9, sorry, I just can't take that too seriously. And if his brother Peter can't take it seriously, I don't either. What is the most logical approach to those who, like Hitchens, reject by far the most convincing and strengthening influence in religion, the spirit, because it is subjective or even mental illness? I don't know that you can convince people like that by logical argument to accept the spirit. It really is a matter of, well, we've already heard a presentation on this. It really is a matter of being open to that influence. And sometimes people like that are converted who are even strong atheists. You remember the story of C.S. Lewis, who kneels down. He said the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England because he felt that it was true. And he was sort of forced to his knees. But there's no way of forcing people, for us to force people, compel them to believe. And I've run into plenty of people who I think have experienced strong spiritual promptings who nonetheless reject them. And you can just hope that with the passage of time they'll become open in some way. I don't see a really good way to... You can argue that it's not mental illness. There is. He makes the claim, for example, he has a whole chapter on religion and health. And I thought there'd be a serious engagement with the rather extensive literature now on how religious people are healthier mentally, physically, socially, emotionally, in every way. All he does, well, as one reviewer put it, he doesn't engage any of the data, but he has the awesome power of anecdotes. And so he tells a couple of stories about obscure African bishops and things like that, which is supposed to show that religion is unhealthy. In fact, the evidence is that religious people are healthier, by and large. And so there is no evidence that religious experiences are the result of mental illness or that people who have them are mentally ill. By and large. And so you can make that kind of logical case, but you can't compel someone who experiences the spirit or something like that to recognize it as such. Is it really worth your time responding in print to such an incompetent Yahoo? Unless it has only taken a few hours to write your response. It almost seems like beating up an invalid. Well, understand. Look, I think the book's a piece of garbage. I'm amazed that it's having the impact it is, but it's having an impact. So on one level, yeah, would it be better to be engaging serious philosophers and thinkers? Yes, it would be. But on the other level, this is a man who's got a best-selling book. He has become a millionaire. The book hasn't even gone into paperback yet. He's on all the TV talk shows. He's all over the place. So yeah, I think it is worth responding to him. I've spent much of my free time in the past years dealing with trash, unfortunately, which is, well, a lot of us do. That's kind of what a lot of this stuff is. But it's not the value of his book. It's the value of the souls that are being damaged by his book, okay? That's why it's worth doing. Not because I ascribe any great importance to Christopher Hitchens as a deep thinker. He's not. There are better atheist thinkers out there, but there aren't many that have become millionaires with atheistic books. He has. Sam Harris has, too. There's a wonderful little episode in a book by Keith Ward, an Oxford philosopher and theologian. It tells about having a debate with Richard Dawkins, the biologist at Oxford, who's become a really vocal atheist spokesman. And afterwards, Dawkins offered him a ride home in his Dawkins Rolls Royce. And Howard says, man, I've chosen the wrong side. Because these guys are getting rich, which means, I don't care about them getting rich, it means their books are selling. And their books become sort of holy writ for a certain audience out there. And that audience needs to realize these books are not well argued, they are not well documented, they are not solid scholarship. In light of your comments about the various lapses by Hitchens, your comments on the PBS documentary on the Mormons, please. Now there's a big topic. The PBS documentary was a mixed bag. It seemed like it was written by different people. There were parts of it that were so good that I thought it was almost as if we had scripted them. You know, the black lady, she was wonderful. She was worth the price of the whole thing. Or the fellow saying, look, you know, after Katrina, with the hurricane, the National Guard was flying overhead, the president was flying overhead, but the only people on the ground with us in New Orleans were the Mormons. You know, that's fabulous. On the other hand, the section about excommunication and so on was just, I was almost ready to put my foot through the TV screen with that. Really infuriating to see that typical high council room. You know, looked like a stage set off Inherit the Wind or something like that. You know, that was just outrageous. But on the other hand, let me say, I've gotten some responses from people that I take very seriously. A person I know back in Virginia wrote to me and said that her husband had gone into work the day following the second episode of the PBS documentary. And his secretary came up to him and said, what do I have to do to join your church? She'd watched it and she said, you know, the people in that film had a joy about them that I don't have in my life, and I would like to have it. Now, that isn't necessarily our response. We look at it and we grit our teeth about the treatment of the Mountain Meadows Massacre and polygamy and all these sorts of things. Another friend of mine who teaches political philosophy at BYU called a friend of his that he knew was going to be watching it, who teaches political philosophy back in the East. And he said, all right, what did you think? And this fellow, who's a practicing Catholic, said much the same thing. He said, what came across in that was the joy of being a believing Latter-day Saint. And my friend said, well, but what about all the negative stuff? And he said, don't pay any attention to that. No one will remember that. You may remember that, but no one else is going to remember that. And they're going to see those happy families and all that sort of thing. This is going to be a positive thing for you. I hope that's true. But I think my fundamental criticism of that program would be that several people were allowed to say that Mormon faith is irrational, that there's no evidence for it, that there's lots of evidence against it, and so on and so forth. And no believing Latter-day Saint, really, was allowed to say anything to the contrary. I know at least one who said it, but it didn't make it into the final product. And so the final upshot of it, I think, was that the message you might get from this is, well, if you can handle the demands, if you're not one of these classes that just don't fit Mormonism, if you can believe it, then it'll make you happy. But it's ultimately irrational, and the Latter-day Saints would be intellectually more honest if they would grant that the founding events of their religion are metaphorical, to be taken purely spiritually, and so on and so forth, which would be to destroy our religion if we were to accept that. The church would not survive that, and of course, I don't believe there's any reason to make that kind of accommodation. But for Helen Whitney, whom I really like, it was clear to me that she was sympathetic, but that she finds our claims absurd. This idea of angels and literal Nephites and all that kind of thing, that's just crazy stuff. But if you could just take it as metaphor, it's a good life for those who can hack it. So...